All right, welcome to the Utopia is a Scam podcast. I'm joined by M. Flynn of Rosewood Doula Trainings today. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Shane?
I am doing quite well. A beautiful morning, drinking cold brew, getting things started off right, you know?
Yeah.
Well, to get right into it, discovering your account and your sort of research was introduced to me by my fiance, who's also in the doula field and learning and training in that department. But she first started mentioning stuff about like baby tech and the SNU a few months ago and in the midst of her training last year and stuff. And I was like, wow, that's fascinating. But I never really dove into it. And then she happened to repost one of your stories, I think a link to one of your kind of a teaser to one of your Patreon posts about the SNU and baby tech and surveillance capitalism. And it was really cool to see somebody who's a totally normal person within the local community, that's you, talking about the technocracy and openly sort of calling out this system of surveillance capitalism that is actively infiltrating all of our lives.
Yeah, I don't know how many people would describe me as normal, but yeah, other than that, the rest is correct.
Normal enough in this realm, because I could say the same about myself. So
yeah.
The thing that stood out to me that really kind of got me fired up, and I followed your Patreon soon thereafter, was one of your posts where you used the terminology, the technocratic model of birth. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit more about that and kind of your understanding of that and how you've used your training and research to understand that terminology?
Yeah. So the technocratic model of birth is a term coined by Professor Robbie Davis Floyd, who's a reproductive anthropologist out of the University of Texas. And she coined that term in 1985. It's not new. It has nothing to do directly with the SNU or any of the sort of contemporary biotech and wearable tech that is just ubiquitous now. But she was very prescient about how highly technological conception and birthing experiences then lead to this sort of gap in expertise or this seeming need for a technological gatekeeper through parenting as well. So she is looking at the sociological impacts of the use of technology in preconception on through parenting. And she focuses a lot on things like the electric fetal monitor, which it seems like that's been around forever. There's definitely this sort of contemporary understanding that having to be hooked up to this machine through all of birth saves babies somehow. And that's definitely what it feels like in hospital births. However, study after study shows that it only increases the chances of cesarean birth with no positive outcomes. And the person who invented the machine never came out and said he basically said it's been used incorrectly. And so that's like one key model of the technocratic model of birth, as opposed to the humanistic model, which is a combination of science and more like alternative, what we consider alternative practice. And then there's the holistic model of birth, which tends to be what we might think of as a little bit farther away from technocratic and a like really stern belief in the natural version of birthing. So the technocratic model is just one of those three models to differentiate the cultural approaches to birth in Western countries.
Yeah, for sure. Like I was sort of humbled and surprised and reminded of when you commented back to me and pointed out that phrase was coined in 1985, kind of had to zoom out of my modern focus on things because we're so enveloped in the technology, the biotech, wearable tech, all this stuff. And kind of got to remind myself that this has been leading up to where we are now for a long time. And even things that seem ubiquitous, like the fetal monitor and simple uses of technology in the birthing process, pre-birthing process, it does exactly that, what you said, and that a lot of these machines and these technologies, they, like you said, a technological gatekeeper, they seem to be protecting humans or providing a service that's benefiting us. But ultimately, from my perspective, when you look at it, it seems like these systems and these technologies only feed the industrial complex by which they are a part of.
Uh-huh.
And even as simple even though it's not that simple, it's simple to us now because it's so ubiquitous, but the fetal monitoring, increasing cesarean births, like that's the, like it's my partner pointed out that, you know, a lot of these, you know, people who are in charge of the birthing process in the hospital, they're surgeons, not necessarily birthing experts, or, you know, they're not providing that humanistic model. It's, we're surgeons, this is what we do. I went to school for 8 to 10 years or whatever it is for this, and this is what we're doing. So,
yeah, which is not the norm in a large portion of the world too. So what's seen as alternative, or what's called alternative around birth and birthing in the US, is really commonplace. In other countries, what we might call like the European model, although there are places that do it better, like New Zealand, they don't have surgeons. They maybe have one or two obstetricians who are, yes, highly skilled, highly trained, necessary surgeons, but they may have one or two on shift on a hospital floor for, you know, 15 midwives and midwives who can come in and out of the hospital that don't have like a hierarchical level. And the difference in the US was like a very specific split that happened in the 1800s, early 1800s. So yeah, this has been building up for a really long time since the advent of surgery as a profession, basically. And then, yeah, I was just reading a really good article on the in Smithsonian Magazine around the crib, and just learned that the crib as we know it was only invented 100 years ago. And it's such this ubiquitous thing now. We in the West, would never think of a baby sleeping anywhere except for a crib. It's one of the first things that you buy or think about when you're pregnant. But then there was this man, Dr. Skinner, who invented something that's essentially the snoo in the 40s. It's an enclosed snoo, and it looks a little bit like an aquarium, but the thought process behind it was pretty similar. It was like observing your baby vigilantly and putting it in this protective bubble, and then being able to sense and read all of these supposed signs of vitality in order to be able to like modify that to make the baby be more independent.
Is that, so is that B.F. Skinner?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and I think they call it like the Skinner box or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right, I came across that one, and I was just like, it always makes me laugh, because it's like, these people, I want to think they mean well, but then when I get down deeper into it, I'm like, no, I think there's something wrong with these people.
I think there's a mix. You know, I think that people want to do well, but then when you look at some of these people, what they mean by that, you know, like the New Zealand, well, he was a Scottish doctor in New Zealand, Sir Truby King. He wanted to do well by little white babies so that there could be more white babies and less Maori babies in New Zealand. So like, sometimes you have to take a step back and look at and examine what these people mean by doing well. And yeah. And Robbie Davis Floyd talks about that a lot. In this idea of the technocratic model of birth creating the type of citizen that is deemed appropriate, that is deemed clean and respectable and morally appropriate, and that we can accept in society. And birth is a representation of that, this very linear, sterile, technologically driven, like can be manipulated with technology and intervention approach is, as she points it out, an echo of our society, or this idea that, you know, mostly white middle class men wanted society to look, starting in the 1800s.
It sounds a lot like basically like a technological adaptation of eugenics and the eugenics models that were so prevalent among the privileged white male sector of social and cultural influencers throughout the last 200, 300, 400, 500 centuries and beyond. But especially where eugenics became an actual practice and a field of study, where people were actively finding means of implementing eugenics all throughout society.
Yeah, and you can't separate the origin of American obstetrics from eugenics and the erasure of the Black Southern granny midwife. They're so intertwined, and that eugenics is such a profound reason why obstetrics is more common in the US and midwives are more common in other countries. There is a distinct, as in so much of American culture, modern culture, it's intertwined, it's interwoven, you can't separate the two.
It's pretty shocking. Like, it's pretty prevalent in society today for people like you and I and our peers and those around us to kind of be well-versed in the fact that this is our culture and there's all these contradicting and controversial things that have happened throughout and we're still kind of living a representation of it. Mm-hmm. But there is like an awareness that we're trying to come around to and get back to some of the things we've lost. But man, if even just in school, if in the earlier years, if you just get a quick hint of some of this stuff, and I think it would provide a much bigger platform for these ideas to kind of take back what's rightfully theirs.
Yeah.
But one of the things that even just mentioning like the technocratic model of birth dating back a few decades now, when you look at it and even going back to the Skinner box and stuff and this whole model taking over things, one of the basic elements of it, I think, is that it sort of undermines and subverts the natural human process and the human instinct that goes along with mothering and birthing and child development, because not that it's a perfect thing, there's always complicated aspects to it, but a mother is a, generally speaking, a baby knows what it needs and a mother instinctively knows how to provide it. And that's, you know, you could pick that apart, but just in the simplest of terms, that's, you know, the holistic, my understanding of how this whole thing kind of works from the beginning and how many processes have stepped in to interrupt that and change it. And yeah. I think, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, no, you're hitting the nail on the head there, that it's, you're taking like a biologically normative approach is kind of the opposite version in anthropology or evolutionary studies. So there's the technocratic lens, which is sometimes seen as being empirical and evidence-based, but that, you know, it's, you know, someone, if you're defining, this is the technocracy, right? You're defining the rules of what is evidence-based in science as well. And then the more, I mean, calling it natural, that's been really co-opted too. So I'm like delicate with those words, but biologically appropriate or physiologically appropriate space where there is, it's a symbiosis and an infant isn't really separate from the birthing parent for, I mean, definitely in that first 4 months, it's like really intricately combined and they're really not two separate individuals entirely. But there's been research to suggest that it's up to 3 years because a toddler even doesn't have a profound sense of self or an understanding or like object permanence. And so there is still such a biological need to be connected to an adult. Luckily, because like the idea of the nuclear family and all is really recent in human development too. So if we look back even broader at this biological basis, it's anyone who cares for an infant is able to start picking up on those rhythms and hormones and adapt their body and their needs to meet these babies' needs as well. And so it's, you know, there is a particular intense dynamic between the person that carried the baby and is maybe feeding the baby with their body, if that's, you know, the family dynamic there, that is different. It's a different hormonal profile, but certainly anyone who's spending a lot of time caring for the baby that's living in the house that is like either a chosen kin or biological kin can fall into these rhythms. And we have such a drive to nourish and nurture these babies. And so it's so interesting when we look at the technocratic model and these more modern ideas of independent child rearing, how that seemed to come from almost nowhere. It just doesn't make any sense. And it's more like, you know, trying to fit a square peg into a circle hole with, we decided culture is going to be this way, we value individualism, so let's work backward to make it so that we can see babies behaving in this way and we think we can have some profound influence and control over it. And even their studies weren't showing that that was true, but they just, it's like, just such a conspiracy theory. Like, whatever, it's never working. We'll say average, even though the percentages are like 37%. Even up until now, these studies around, you know, supposed normal infant sleep, they'll be like, oh, babies do this and you can do this. And seriously, that the number that they're basing it on is like 40%, 37%, way less than average or median or anything.
It's like not. They always, like you said, evidence-based learning or evidence-based studies and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good thing, you would think, but ultimately the way the studies and stuff are framed, of course there's going to be evidence provided, but it's how it's framed to make it seem like this is the result and this is how we're telling you it is.
Yeah. And sometimes you take a deeper look into those studies, like one I was looking at earlier this week from J.B. Watson, was that they managed to create an artificial lightning room that they would put like four-day-old infants in to startle them. And then they decided that from studies like this in the hospital, like, you know, babies separated from their parents and then shocked with fake lightning in a dark room. And then they were like, from this, okay, babies have three emotions: fear, love, and rage. And those are the emotions. And then from that, then you use behavioral modification techniques to get the baby to utilize those emotions to create a morally well-behaved, appropriate baby that is the type of person that you want them to be. Like, cool, that is considered a study, that is research, and forms a lot of the basis of behaviorism as a study in psychology.
It's like... it's interesting that you did that, but do we need to use it as like the stuff that we're basing our actions in today's world on, you know? Yeah. I'm really glad you said behavioral impact studies or changing behavioral, because it kind of ties back into what we see unfolding with baby technology and your word that you use, robo-moms. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's sort of at the point where it's, people are buying into it, I think, under the convenience factor of helping them parent and helping them adapt to being a parent in today's world. But what's being built around these systems and these data models is human impact markets and biocapitalism and essentially behavioral change impact bonds and a brand new financial structure is being built around this type of technology being amongst the public. And I've always been aware of, you know, how social media and iPhones and all this technology and wearable tech is influencing and changing our lives and creating massive data commodities. But when I started to look into the baby technology, it's almost like that's one step ahead of where we as adults, if you will, in the adult world are currently living. The baby tech model seems to be a starting point, a segue into the deeper model of where this is going.
Yeah, I feel that way too when I read. So I think I sent this to you when we were talking about this before, but I really like Kara Swisher. She's just so entertaining and wonderful. The opinion writer at the New York Times, who focuses a lot on technology and emerging technology. And she's critical of a lot of things, but she's also, you know, kind of like, I don't know, she's comfortable with a lot more stuff than I think we probably are. But she wrote this article on Amazon's Halo, the new smartwatch, and their way of basically, because they're getting into the pharmaceutical market. So it's their way of giving you this sense of what your mood is and how your heart rate is. And like, it's Fitbit, Apple Watch on steroids, plus like weird Cali Posse vibe, pseudoscience, pop psychology, whatever that you wear. And then it tells you based on, it's listening to you all the time. And it tells you based on certain words you use or patterns of words and tone, what your mood might be, in order to then make suggestions, you know, whatever. It's collecting that data. And if you're connected to Amazon, next time you go on to the marketplace. It's going to spit you back something in an effort to make you feel different or confirm that mood. And who gets to set what mood is what is just like, I could go on about that forever. it's bizarre. But when I was reading that, I was thinking back to my SNOO research from the week before and the outlet and the wearable baby tech, and how in the app features now they're starting to use AI to personalize the data messages you're getting on your phone, the updates, you know, usually in the morning, most of these around infant sleep. So parents are, I mean, I know parents using these devices already look at their phone to know about what their baby was doing before they look at their baby, before they talk to each other about what the night would be, or even have a personal reflection of how the night went. They have to look at the phone to confirm or to understand the framework that they might use to think about maybe how the baby did. It's so convoluted and bizarre. But now with the AI, they're starting to make it so that it's like, good morning, Dad. I had a great night. I was a little bit gassy. I slept this much. This is how it's improving from the night before. We're doing great. I cuddled, I cued, I looked at this. And I know from going in and digging into the terms of service of all of these things that they all sell this data and anything collected to third parties, and that they waive all these companies, SNOO, Owlet, et cetera, waive the terms of service. Like it's, you know, you're now entering into another contract that you have with any of these bodies, but you have no idea who it is. And I mean, beyond that being weird and depending on where you fall, maybe not ethical and strange, and the AI is very bizarre and weird.
Creepy.
It's then, you know, you take into account, and I'm so bad with names, so I'm blanking on the researcher's name, but a Princeton sociologist did a study in 2014 when she was pregnant and found that a pregnant person, in 2014, a pregnant person's views of an ad is worth, or their attention is worth $1.50, where the normal person, or non-pregnant person's view is worth 10 cents. And I imagine that's even more inflated now. So if you imagine that they're collecting all this data and saying, you know, Mom, I had a really bad night, that then the Google Nest or whatever can then automatically send you a shopping list of things to take that bad night away, supposedly.
Yeah, I'm like over here actually cringing, like physically cringing at the AI impression of how the baby's speaking to Dad. It's just like, it's so typical of how these tech models operate, is that it always attempts to emulate human behavior and relate to human behavior. But to me, it's just always such a glaring fraud of it. And it's just like, okay, we could maybe use some technology to help us along the way, but why do you got to be so creepy about it, you know?
Yeah. If you read anything by the woman that runs AI is Weird, that blog, and she has a book, You Look Like a Thing and I Love You, and it's about weird AI. I'm also blanking on her name. I'm so bad with names. I'm sorry. Okay. But she does amazing research. She like tinkers around with AI all the time. And
it gets so weird.
So weird. And so if you think back, like, just this bizarreness that might be bred of this kind of, like, personalized baby tech. And then is the SNOO then giving your baby a personality?
Wow, that's such a good question. I wanted to say that, like, how you were pointing out about these data commodities and manipulating parents into these systems. It's like with every emerging technology, there's an emerging market or emerging markets, especially now. And what we see with the point you just made about the SNOO giving your child a personality is basically with all this technology that we're kind of being molded to accept into all of our lives, starting with especially the point I made about babies. basically, it seems like the goal here, or the end game, is not even the end game, just kind of the direction we're going, is that life as an individual is not a path of self-direction and choice, and you're not fulfilling your own destiny. You're going through like almost a user experience, uh-huh. like a game mode where, just like you said about, you know, mom checks the phone app before checking on the baby. It uh-huh. becomes a game, a user experience where you're no longer connected to your child. You're connected virtually to your child. You're checking your phone for the information instead of getting the information directly from the baby that's in the other room or uh-huh. right next to you even. It's like, what are we trying to do here? And it's like the SNU is just the beginning, but even that is such a big, huge thing that I'm like, wow, that's amazing. Incredible.
Yeah. And it is as addictive as any other feature and function of the way our hardware interacts with the software too, in that, you know, I've worked with families where the kiddos are going on 3 months and they're still tracking every time the baby pees and poops, which is incredibly irrelevant. At that time, that data does not contribute to safety or health or thriving. And, you know, I'll be sitting with them after several hours and then someone will realize, oh my God, we didn't put the poops into the data. And then it becomes this thing that they have to do that interrupts whatever experience is happening. And sometimes these sorts of things actually require you physically moving away from the baby to input baby data, which that when those dynamics are happening, and I see it all the time now, like I can't think of anything that so profoundly misses the point than that sort of like interactive user experience where the device takes precedence over the child. But I can think of like 75 different examples of that and how pervasive it is. And it really in most of the families' homes that I'm working with, but I, you know, I'm working with like upper middle class Bay Area families primarily. But, you know, I was seeing that even when I was working in Colorado, it was less tech, but it was still sort of like, I don't know, at the time everybody was obsessed with the nose Frida and the diaper warmer, and those things didn't track and resell data, yeah. but those things got marketed and sold to those people through the same surveillance capitalism methods of announcing to the internet through your search history that you're pregnant. So, you know, it was the baby, it was the like primordial ooze of this craziness.
Totally.
Like 5 or 6 years ago when I was there too, so.
Talk about conspiracy theory. It's the analogy would be that taking the parents' attention away from the baby or the children is the AI behind the system that's taking the data in. It needs to be fed, you know, it's hungry. You got to feed it. It's asking for it. It's there. You're supposed to do it, you know?
Yeah. And like with the wearable tech too, that right. That it's, you can be holding your baby and then your Apple Watch is telling you to do something with your baby. And it's just like that kind of disconnect where you're relying on the data monster to signal a biological need when, you know, babies aren't really that complicated when it comes to pretty basic cues. And then to tie back into what you were saying about, you know, that a parent would know best, that there is a natural order of things that parents have given the space, and if they're allowed to rest their higher brain, the primal brain is super activated in this time. It is a biological process. It's very efficient. It has kept us alive for, you know, ever and ever and ever as a species. There's never been a need for something else to tell us what's going on with our babies. There is, if given that space, I mean, the woo-woo way to say it is intuition, but it is a biological conversation that's pre-verbal and has nothing to do with data collection. And there's so many easy, simplistic signs that a baby needs something or a baby is satiated. And by relying on that, the technology, we're taking away parents' ability to learn those things and to figure them out for themselves or with some supportive community guidance. And then what happens when the battery dies, there is a glitch, you can't afford the next subscription payment, you have to return the device, it becomes these systems of addiction. And then you have to if it's not working, parents then go, we're not working right, not that the machine isn't working correctly.
Exactly. And that's, again, it's subverting the natural human process. And I think what you just said about the actual natural processes of things is that that's the most important thing that we have as a species, honestly. If we can't raise children, if we can't birth children into this world and raise them and trust ourselves to make mistakes, but also do the right thing, which is what our parents did and the parents before them and all that. It's like, once you allow something else into that process, which it's happening, it's done, mm-hmm. it's happening as we speak. Once you allow something else into that process, it's going to change it. And there are repercussions to that. And I think we're starting to see them unfold, but we're really at the forefront of it. So it's scary.
It's the illusion. You said convenience. I think there are elements of the software that seem like convenience. But the gadgetry is not necessarily seen as convenient. The actual hardware, it's very fear-based and it's very control-based. And so it's this idea that these things help you have control over the situation, which is, that's like Professor Robbie's really big thing, is this idea that there are predictable systems and outcomes for it's man trying to have control over the natural process. That's part of the reason why it's taken such hold over the birthing process, because that is like you're saying, the ultimate physiological, very human, very natural process that we haven't, I mean, they're working on it. Ectogenesis is biobag babies, fetuses that can be grown outside of a body. They still need, well, at this point, even they still need like a body to conceive and grow, but there is a movement to get rid of human bodies to create more humans. And if you're thinking of the scene in The Matrix, that is what that is.
No, that's really it though, because not to get too crazy with it, but you know, my research into the technocracy and all this stuff, now that I'm coming around to the birth work side of it, it's super fascinating and a lot more personal. But a lot of my research, especially this past year, has been around the fourth industrial revolution, which is, you know, this concept, this whole agenda put together by the World Economic Forum, all their NGOs and corporate entity sponsors and philanthropists, where if you start breaking down their own data points and how they see this fourth industrial revolution taking place, it's biocapitalism for one, the complete restructuring of our financial system based around biological human activity. And when you talk about the scene in The Matrix where the humans are like plugged in or whatever, and the system's feeding off of them, they're fueling the system. That's kind of what they're actually envisioning, where it's digital identity and your biometrics and your biological activity with wearable tech or implantable tech or whatever it is all monitored, and all data creation points are fed into the system, to where, again, going back to that user experience point I made, is life is modeled around this user experience where basically everybody but the elite who are investing in human impact and behavior change models and hedge funds. It sounds crazy. I feel insane saying it as if it's normal, but that's really this is just the beginning. So it's like, it's not too late. That's not our destiny. I'm not saying we're doomed, but there are people who want to use these models to further advance these things and take away what we've built. So,
yeah, I also feel like a nutcase sometimes with this, and I don't know that I would be in this line of thought or on the same page as you if I weren't in American birth work and birth culture, because like you noted before, the sort of science fiction extreme elements of this stuff already exists with babies. They're already experimenting there. And it's one, because babies don't have a way to make informed choices for themselves. And then the bigger element of it, and it's where my research is ultimately heading, is because of things like personhood laws and fetal protectionism over the body of the person carrying the baby, which ectogenesis is like the peak of that. It's like, we don't even need to bother with this person's body, particularly female, or like traditionally female bodies in a female space. It's like, we can just get rid of that nuisance and unpredictability and cyclical nature and varying nature, and we can put this baby in a bag that is see-through and look at it and control it. Because I mean, that's where the technology is heading. In like, the outlet has now is about to launch a pregnancy band that you can wear that has a sensor over a pregnant belly that can then track the baby minute by minute to your phone through pregnancy. So we're going, I mean, we're getting there. That is, well, we're there.
what was the word for the growing the baby outside of the?
Ectogenesis.
Ectogenesis. If that doesn't sound dystopian science fiction nightmare, then.
Okay. So Jenny Kleeman is the happiest. I stumbled upon her on accident looking for Jenny Odell, another fantastic writer. About technology and what it's doing to culture. But Jenny Kleeman wrote this phenomenal book called Sex, Robots, and Vegan Meats, which I highly recommend. And one of the sections is on highly technological birth. It's on ectogenesis, and it's fantastic. And she's not someone who's immersed in birth culture. She's an investigative journalist in the UK. And so it has a different take than maybe, you know, like someone like me or your fiance would take on it. But that's kind of refreshing too. It's not so steeped in birth culture. It's steeped in just culture. Yeah. And it's sort of an outsider's perspective looking in on this. And it's really interesting, going back to your very first point about, you have to think about, these people have good intentions. So these researchers at CHOP really do want to save babies. But there is an icky, weird element of, at the expense, some might argue, of, you know, something that is an, can be and should be an empowering process for the person who is pregnant and giving birth. That you just don't even need, I mean, so much of birth acts like the female body is just in the way. And then, you know, that gets even more complex with, like, the liminal space of non-binary and trans parents too. And it just, like, you can keep getting deeper and deeper, and it's just like anything that is not male machine body is an inconvenience. Yeah, and that plays so much into parenting and birth.
Yeah, I wanted to make that point about reading one of your Patreon posts about how so many of these, even just the process of birthing, traditional birthing in hospitals, all up to the technology involved in birthing process and parenting, so much of it is male designed and built around the model of the male body. And it's just, what could be more wrong than that, you know?
Well, so much of it's of modern obstetrics is still based on the invention of the surgeon, where they used to come in when midwives needed. I mean, the invention of the forceps is actually a great thing. You know, cesarean births and forceps have a lot of issues, but, you know, sometimes operative birth is beneficial. So anyway, when surgeons and obstetricians started to even be a thing to make something for themselves, and it really was just about men coming in and making money off of every area of biology that they possibly could. But a lot of these original obstetricians hated the female body. I mean, openly hated the female body. And then to even tend to these women in, you know, Enlightenment period and Victorian period, where this was these two big bursts of this becoming a profession, they wouldn't even look at the vagina of a birthing person, they would do everything, including using forceps under a sheet. So there's a literal disconnect in the standards, the modern standards that we use in this whole process, because it has been structured and defined by men who were, it's like not subtle misogyny at all.
Overt. Violent misogyny. It's so terrible. Yeah. It's just like, it's disgusting. Honestly, I can't even really wrap my head around the full scope of things, because we're living in a society, and especially in America, where the medical industrial complex is so powerful and so pervasive in cultural and dominating the cultural norms of very natural ancient human practices. And again, just the common theme here, but it's the same sort of model of subverting humanity under technology or under misogyny, or it's all sort of the same, falls under the same blanket of something negative that's affecting humanity moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, the history of the creation of the speculum too, and J. Marion Sims, and not only just hating female bodies, but being virulently racist and experimenting on the bodies of enslaved women. And that also creates this foundation that we have, that when I read more about that and reading Dorothy Roberts and reading Deirdre Cooper's works on this, and Ricky Salinger, Loretta Ross, all these incredible researchers that are tracing the like very particularly American situation of that, again, that intersection of racism and obstetrics, that carrying that in, I mean, that's so in the back of my head in thinking about this baby tech as surveillance tech too, as a way to monitor the morality of parents, that these things are no longer just within the community space and kin space, and it's no longer even within this realm of like 1950s nuclear private family, that because these things are constantly, there's a push to monitor and surveil and to have that go off to who knows what else, that we already know that there's some data collection from government, but I mean that, you know, Amazon Ring has a connection to ICE, and Google Nest and all that has given information over to law enforcement bodies, and Alexa has been subpoenaed.
The Pentagon, Department of Defense, it's all connected.
Yeah, exactly. That I'm trying to figure out, and again, this is where I feel a little bit, I'm either going to be prescient or crazy, and you know, there's always that weird time where you're not sure. But we know that more families of color are reported to child protection services, that at what point, I'm like so nervous about this idea that if a highly technological parenting experience is seen as the like good, the white, clean, middle class good of parenting, that if everyone can be monitored and there's deviation from that, which is like the majority of people, but certainly the majority of people of color in the United States, that if their homes and their babies are being surveilled, like literally surveilled inside, will there be differences in, say, like when the outlet sock goes off in the middle of the night for very, you know, it goes off all the time for nonsense reasons. It's a terrible, stupid device. That if that baby is being fed in the middle of the night by a bottle and that sock goes off in the home of a person of color, when are they going to start rushing the doors of these families?
Even if it's just a, probably be framed as something as a welfare check or social interaction or some, you know, how they frame, they use this language to code their actual intentions behind it. But exactly like you said, at what point does it become not just intrusive, but weaponized, to where these people can be made victim further by circumstances that surround them, and by trying to adhere to the model of the goodness, if you will, the cleanliness, by trying to adhere to it, they're actually sort of feeding the system that's already against them in the first place. So with that sort of stuff, you see it's a very, very slippery slope. And I think there's already kind of examples from American culture where, you know, the technology is bad, and especially bad for these communities. But yeah, I'm wondering myself because again, this whole new model of trying to restructure society and change financial models, part of the whole system is kind of the end of the nuclear family and communitarianism, which sounds really positive and friendly. Communitarianism taking over the process of, you know, instead of two parents, it's the community, which that's sort of a traditional approach too. But under this circumstance, it's more the communitarian perspective is the state and the technology is monitoring and guiding the parenting process and the childhood development.
Yeah, I was just reading a philosophical dissertation from two researchers in Serbia, of all places, writing about the overuse of quote-unquote science in parenting, but like parenting as a culture, as a verb, and how we've actually totally depersonalized the idea of parenting, and where it used to be the role of the community, and the infant was seen as just a member of the community with unique needs, but that could be met by a whole community on a small, tight-knit band. Now, with the like quote-unquote science or evidence of mostly behavioralism, that the culture of parenting is that parent, that the child is a product, the parents, parenting is a job, and you have to like produce this child, and it's this responsibility of the parents to educate themselves, to understand the evidence. But their whole thing on why that's not good is that it is this model of parenting as a political act. Then, and the politics of the day, the trends of politics of the day influence that, regardless of what biology dictates at all, or what like humans actually need. And so it has this guise of like positive neuroscience and whatever, but it has nothing to do with like evolutionary realities of what people need. It's just, again, this idea of like creating this good citizen, but that is a cloaking for a good moral, probably white, probably Christian, probably like these same things that have been seen as quote unquote good for a really long time.
Trying to make it that fit that model of quote unquote goodness, or also trying to subvert it enough so that it's influenceable, or it's able to be guided to a certain, just like behavior modification on the broader scale of things. It's, oh, well, we've raised you this way. This is kind of what you're meant to be. So we'll fit you into this category of society.
Well, if you look at again, to go back to what one of the things that makes me nervous at how far this is going is that, and these researchers point out that this really became a really big standard wide sweeping thing in the 90s. And if we remember the late 80s and early 90s and the like widespread moral panics, the satanic panic, and particularly the supposed crack baby epidemic.
Yeah.
And we look again at these studies that came out around this idea that babies born to parents who were under the influence of crack cocaine were underdeveloped, that they were non-responsive, that they were basically less than human. Those studies now have been disproven in a lot of ways, or some of those influences were completely different or totally out of context in a lot of ways. But that created a ton of impetus for personhood laws and other moral, political, and hospital policies. And it was based on it was like modern eugenics in a lot of ways. We look at the broader picture of the crack epidemic. And so it became this thing of like, that really helped form this idea of a good parent and a bad parent and how much influence parents have on behavioral modification through like supposed biological tinkering. And all of those things are still creating this bedrock. We're still in that mindset as the technology is being created. And so this idea that we can separate the technology from the culture that's creating it, especially when this idea of being a parent is such a big part of the moral identity, supposedly, of Western culture now, I just like only see bad things happening from it. I have a really hard time looking. There's a few bright spots. There's a few good places for infant technology, I think, but just being like something you can buy and have delivered to your home and it being unregulated is really scary to me, especially when it collects data and makes assessments based on that.
Yeah, this, the whole data thing, like you mentioned it earlier, how trying to, the human question is always trying to control outcomes and predict what's going to happen next. And that's where data and algorithms come into play. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not a human brain doing it. It's its own thing. And what these data algorithms end up coming up with for solutions, as they call them, that's a big word in this emerging market, is solutions. Mm-hmm. Their solutions are molded to continue to build and expand the technology always. So I'm right there with you when it comes to only seeing negatives. I don't want to see negatives.
I know. Sometimes I'm like, oh, I hate this. And then it kind of is working for a family. And I'm like, I guess I won't, whatever, their tub takes the temperature of the water. I can't be too mad. Or, you know, the thing that pre-measures the warm water for the formula. I'm like, it's not the worst thing on earth.
So that's like the harmless convenience side of like, oh, okay, nah, you know, like whatever, but still I'm with you where it's just like, do we need this?
So the thing was like that it's a futures market, and to like to borrow the language of Shoshana Zuboff, that it is that the algorithm to try and predict behavior is really scary. And so I always tell people like the baby Brezza doesn't bother me now. When it becomes a quote unquote smart device, which it will, yep. You know, not all of these things in baby tech used to just be hardware. The point was for it to be hardware, the hands-free breast pumps and the swings that just used to rock babies, whatever. They were just a piece of gadgetry. They were cheap plastic and there were problems with the design and how expensive they were and whatever. But everything is moving into the Internet of Things because that is the foundation of this economy and the futures. And so it is, like you're saying, it's like predicting a problem or predicting a solution and then marketing a problem. And that is so goddamn apparent in parenting. And it is so, they are the easiest market because there is this social pressure to be a good parent and that you have so much control over having a good baby. It's very, very lucrative to keep that message going.
Very manipulative, mm-hmm. Driven by algorithmic solutions. And you said the Internet of Things. That's what I mentioned earlier about the Fourth Industrial Revolution. The Fourth Industrial Revolution is built on the Internet of Things. And when I mentioned the new emerging markets, and you just said it, human futures markets based on human activity, biological human data and activity, is it's the Internet of Things, but it's also the Internet of Bodies. Uh-huh. And that's what we got to start taking very, very seriously, because if we don't pay attention to what's happening now and what this system is being designed and built to be able to accomplish, then we're going to be caught flat-footed as a society. And next thing you know, the Internet of Bodies is going to be the most normal, prevalent thing around us. And it's human capital markets. It's the behavior modification investment banking. It's everything evil that we've known about for so long converging into one giant control mechanism, and it's mind-blowing.
It'll be hegemonic, and it'll be narrow, and it'll be these awful just like virulent guys with bad haircuts like Mark Zuckerberg design, giving you a narrow set of options for personality. I mean, that's, you know, Jaron Lanier is always talking about that the internet used to be weird and creative, and now you plug in, you like check off boxes. And so again, I'm seeing that with that like weird baby AI that you are basically, you know, with the snoo, you're given the option of having a baby that's a good sleeper or a bad sleeper based on a set of data that was developed by men based on a concept of an idea from the 1900s and it's early 1900s. And so it's just, you know, yes, the, all the algorithms and the AI are kind of like becoming their own entity, but it's, they're built and based off of ideas of a very small subset of human people who are looking at something and saying, this is culture, and then shaping culture to fit within that frame. And that's also really dangerous. And the Internet of Things, that it's just continuing to narrow this idea of personality and give you very little room. And so this, you have this illusion of control, right? Parents think that they have a lot of control, and that's why they like go with the technological model of birth. That's why they continue with the technocracy in postpartum, but they're completely giving up control because now they're shoving their parenting and shoving the baby's biology into a personality and a set of norms defined by somebody else. And that's what I see as being really frustrating and dangerous.
Again, it's subverting the natural human process of, instead of raising your kid and helping them develop their personality and develop into a human being, a functional human being. It's okay. You might have that ability. You might maintain that ability, but you end up giving a lot of it away to the technology. And at what point is the technology so advanced that your input isn't going to matter? Your input doesn't matter anymore because the technology is running so many algorithms and so many problems and so many solutions that it's pretty much controlling the outcome. And that's, again, going back to the markets thing, it's controlling outcomes, predicting outcomes, mm-hmm. impacting behavior, all these things that are just right in our face.
Yeah. All of these, the baby technology is becoming more and more dependent on each other. And the baby tech companies are seeing that market opportunity. And so where there was just the outlet, there is now the outlet video monitor, the sock, the belly band. So you can have a whole suite now of baby surveillance technology starting in utero. That's not a company that's been around for very long. And so they're in it, their infancy, you know, sorry to have a pun there, but you know, they have so much more opportunity to expand and to create markets. And with the release of that belly band, there'll be 10 more. Just like the release of the outlet meant that I just found out that the Nanu, that video camera that everybody loves, now has more sensors and now has data collection and now also has a band that you can buy that's a heart monitor. And so all of these companies are seeing what's going on and they're creating niche markets and expanding in the markets that already exist that are unnecessary. And I've been doing this work for 11 years and this stuff is very, very new and it's moving very fast and it feels super overwhelming to be questioning at all.
Yeah. I mean, like you just said about the technology creates the need for niche markets and like emerging technologies are based on algorithm predictions and now they're designed to create new markets. And then once you, it's like a feedback loop where the system is just built to keep creating new markets and new markets, new markets, emerging markets. And it's that model that's going to bring us into the Internet of Things and Internet of Bodies. And again, it seems simple and like where you have like a 10-year retrospective on like the development of these smart systems right now, and it seems subtle when it's happening, but looking back on it, it's like holy shit, what is like
the most technological houses I've been in, the babies seem almost irrelevant. I am talking to people who are talking to me about numbers and looking at their phones. And in cases of extreme postpartum anxiety or depression, one of the hallmarks of that is that a lot of times those families will stop calling the baby its name and will kind of go back to calling it. And it becomes the baby, and then they use the proper nouns of the devices as well. So the baby is just kind of shuffled in as an object that maybe outputs data in conversation with this new, they become almost interchangeable in a way that's very frightening and strange to me. And I do get how that probably seems totally insane to people. And it's only been in small kind of extreme cases that I've seen it get that bad. But again, this technology is very new. And each home I go into, and I screen my clients pretty well. Like, I tend not to work with people who are a little bit more distant, but sometimes they hire me in pregnancy and then they have a traumatic birthing experience, and then the gadgetry becomes even more significant and the trauma is significant and the postpartum mood disorders become significant, and then these things start piling up. And at this point I just have a addendum to my contract saying I'm not going to touch any of those things. I'm not going to download apps on my phone. I'm not going to talk about the apps. I won't recommend them. I won't plug anything in. It's a liability issue. And also it makes my job harder. So I'm not doing it.
Yeah. Well, good on you for that, at least. It's such a weird time because these issues that we're talking about are affecting us globally. It's an entire societal issue. But individually, it's really the choices that we make individually that kind of fuel these systems, but it's hard to do the right thing all the time. And when you're surrounded by it, and it's hard to figure out what impact your choices are going to be able to have on the system developing, but it's better to not embrace it. Like how you said about not, you know, on your contract and stuff, not embracing that stuff, but.
And just sending that to them starts the conversation at least too. And if I can at least get there with them, especially if they're still pregnant and thinking that everybody's telling them that they desperately need this thing, to have at least one voice that says, hey, I've worked with 500 families. You definitely don't need any of this. Like, you need a basket and food in your fridge and some diapers and you'd be fine.
If that message gets through to more families going forward, I think we'll be on the right track, but it's hard to say.
Yeah.
Hopefully. I know you probably got to go soon. I don't want to take too much of your time, but any thoughts on further solutions, or if you want to plug your Patreon, feel free to do that too, because it's a great page of resources, tons of research. You're impressively academic and humanistic in your approach to this whole thing. So really applaud you for that.
Thank you. I'm glad to have an outlet for some of this. It was all trapped in my brain for so long. For me, at least, you know, very specifically, I think that birth workers are positioned to do a lot of like social justice work that's even very subtle. I think we can make huge environmental impacts, and I think we can make giant impacts on the medical system. And I see us having a pretty firm role in rolling back some of this technological invasion, because parents are so open and receptive in this time to get information, and like having gatekeepers is a very human experience in the birthing process, or very like mammalian experience. Even whales and dolphins have midwives and, you know, kind of elders that help them birth. So in that kind of, and that's my favorite part of birth work, is kind of this community sage, woman of wisdom situation that, you know, midwives and doulas are able to have that role in a community. And so as I keep educating birth workers, I want to keep having this as a focus. And so I think, doulas questioning it, doulas figuring out how to have these conversations with their clients and with families and friends, especially earlier on, if they're, especially birth doulas, if they're able to work with folks earlier on in their parenting journey, the better. And then for the rest of us, I think it's, you know, questioning how much this stuff is actually contributing to your life. And if the trade-off, I think educating yourself more on what the trade-offs for convenience, supposed convenience, I mean, half of this stuff is not technology, as our technological glitch earlier in the day kind of attested.
Exactly.
No, it's not always easier.
I was going to make the point about how these companies, these new companies produce all sorts of technology and stuff. It's ironic because we're talking on Zoom. When our technological glitch took place, I have this Zoom recorder thing that I plug my microphone into and such. And like, it just created a mess that we were not able to connect with. But about doulas and birth workers' role in this whole thing, the way my partner framed doula work to me when she first started going to classes for it was a huge part of it is advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
Advocate, and then it's the choice of what you're advocating for, right? So advocating for the mother, advocating for the baby, but in the larger scope of things in the world we're in, it's kind of advocating for the world, the advocating for the human side of it, advocating for tradition and reattaching ourselves to things that got us here in the first place and not relying so heavily on systems that are obviously manipulating us into needing them. And there's mm-hmm. that addiction side of things.
I think remembering and moving forward, spreading the word that autonomy doesn't necessarily come at the expense of safety. And that is the driving force that has to be there underlining a lot of this biotech. Because we're told, especially new parents, are told the complete opposite. You have to give all of this up in order to have your baby be healthy. And that's just a complete lie. It's an absolute lie. So yeah, that's the message that I'm trying to spread with all of this. You can be empowered and autonomous and human without all of this crap.
Breaking away from that fear-based, fear-driven agenda behind the technology and stuff too is like, once you kind of break through on that too and people can see that it's fear-based and addictive, then that information is scary in itself. So that kind of makes you want to turn inward and do what's right.
When I'm reading the SNU and the Owlet website, sometimes I'm like, oh my God, is this safer? What am I talking about? And then I realize that, no, I've seen it in action a million times. It does nothing for no one.
No benefit other than the purpose that it serves itself in its own marketplace, then it's, yeah, the benefit is slim to none, and if not negative, in the negative.
Totally. yeah, I have to get going because I have to go interact with a human baby.
Awesome.
And but yeah, my Patreon is Rosewood Repro, and that's my Instagram handle too, so people can find me on those two spots pretty easily.
Highly recommend. Em, thank you so much for joining me. I feel like I learned a lot. I feel like I have a lot of research points to go after now, and I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks. You too. And you'll get another article tonight with your membership. So another
one coming up. Looking forward to it. All right, until next time.
Bye.